Well, we're going to continue on in our teaching series this morning. We've been going through the book of Judges. I hope that you've been enjoying this book. It's been a challenging one, hasn't it? It seems like every single week reading the stories and going, wow, what are we going to do with this one? And it's family friendly too. So it just kind of ups the ante. Earlier this week, I was having one of those moments as I was looking through the text that we're going to be looking at this morning, and I thought, man, this is a weird story. I wonder how many of the weirdest stories in the Bible are found right here in this chapter, right here in this book, actually, of Judges. So I did the Google search, like weird Bible stories, and I'm sure a whole bunch of experts have been writing these. But there was one site in particular. He had the top 10 weirdest Bible stories, and two of them were in the book of Judges, and I felt, yes, this is good. It's not just me that thinks that they are odd. And of course, there was some stories in Genesis and in Exodus as well. But the two weirdest ones in Judges that they had listed there was the story of Ehud. We looked at him our second week in this series, the left-handed warrior. And it has that nice lengthy description about how he was slain in his bathroom. And then the next weirdest story, I think this was number two or three on the list, is the story that's found in the last few chapters in the book of Judges, Judges 19 through 21. And Pastor Brad's going to look at that in a couple of weeks. So that should hopefully get you all to read that story a few times and really scratch your head, because it is a very, very strange story. But today's story isn't so much strange as I would call it just plain odd. A few months ago when I read this story, as Brad and I were preparing for this series, I read it and honestly I thought, what in the world is this story even in the Bible for? Like, what is going on? We've got a bunch of characters, obviously they're involved in a bunch of sin, but like, what's the point of this story? And I hadn't ever remembered reading this story before. It was sort of like, boom, it was there and I'd missed it every other time. But here it is. Here's the story of a man named Micah, a man who is referred to as a Levite priest, and then a whole group of people from the tribe of Dan, and it spans through chapters 17 and 18 in the book of Judges, and it's just sort of odd. But thanks be to God that through his Spirit, he teaches us through stories that are just plain odd in some sense. And so we're going to look at this story in faith, knowing that God's word is living and it's relevant for our lives, and we're going to do what we can to see what it meant to that original audience and how it's going to provide nourishment to our souls this morning. If we remember, one of the major themes in the book of Judges, especially in the first part of the book, we see that reoccurring phrase that the narrator uses over and over again, that the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And that's kind of the catchphrase that we see, and then it goes into that pattern of God providing a judgment upon the people to have them come back to him, and then him raising up a deliverer, and then going through those same sort of things, and then once again they do evil in the eyes of the Lord. Well, in the last few chapters of Judges, it seems to get even worse. It's kind of progressively going downhill. And so the next phrase that we hear is somewhat similar, but we see it twice in this story, and I think twice in the later chapters. Israel had no king, so the people did whatever seemed right in their own eyes. That's a phrase that we see over and over and over again in these last few stories. So that's how chapter 17, verse 6, it's there in that verse, and then also at the beginning of chapter 18. Israel had no king. They had no physical or spiritual direction in their life, and so they did whatever seemed right in their own eyes. And so we see that this story is full of idolatry, personal will, and an astounding ignorance of God. Now, it might be difficult for us to imagine a society that has those sort of actions and principles in their lives, but do your best to go back into that ancient civilization and imagine a world where it was full of idolatry and personal will and an astounding ignorance of God. We're going to look at this story together, and there are some notes up there on the PowerPoint slides. We're going to look at some direct quotes from the story, and also I'll paraphrase some of it. So beginning in chapter 17, the author goes right into the story, and he says that a man named Micah lived in the hill country of Ephraim, And one day he said to his mother, I heard you curse the thief who stole 1,100 pieces of silver from you. Well, here they are. I was the one who took them. The Lord bless you for admitting it, his mother replied. He returned the money to her, and she said, I now dedicate these silver coins to the Lord. In honor of my son, I will have an image carved and an idol cast. So his mother took 200 of the silver coins to a silversmith who made them into an image and an idol, and these were placed in Micah's house. So Micah sets up a shrine, he makes a sacred ephod and some other household idols, and then he installs one of his own sons as priest. And then the narrator inserts this editorial comment that I just mentioned earlier, that Israel had no king in those days, and so everyone did what seemed right in their own eyes. And this comment pretty much explains the whole rationale for what happens in those first five verses. And then in verse 7, a new character is introduced. He's described as a young Levite. He leaves his place of residence, and he stumbles across Micah's home in Ephraim. And Micah asks him who he is and where he's from, and the Levite tells him what's going on and that he's looking for a place to stay. And so Micah replies in the story. He says, stay here with me, and you can be a father and a priest to me. I'll give you 10 pieces of silver a year, plus a change of clothes and food. So the Levite agrees to this offer, and Micah ordains the Levite as his personal priest, and he lives in Micah's house. And Micah says, I know the Lord will bless me now, because I have a Levite serving as my priest. Well, the story continues on in chapter 18, and the author feels once again it's necessary to remind everyone that there's no king, everyone's doing whatever they want to do, and so there's going to be some more sinful chaos that's going to ensue. Now we have a new set of characters. We have five spies, or kind of people who are scouting out what's going to happen, from the tribe of Dan. And we're reminded that the tribe of Dan, when the land was conquered and when it was distributed to the different tribes, the land of Dan, they actually never took the land that was allotted to them. It was full of Philistines who were pretty mighty and scary, and so the Danites thought, well, I'd rather not do that. And so they were basically without a home. So they decide to have these five capable warriors go out and basically find a place to live. And so as they're on their journey, they stumble across Micah's house and they spend the night there. And they realize that Micah's young priest is a Levite, probably due to his accent. And so they ask him why he's at Micah's house and what he's doing there. And the Levite tells them the agreement that he made with Micah. And so his response prompts the five Danites to ask in verse 5, ask God whether or not our journey will be successful. And the priest replies, go in peace, for the Lord is watching over your journey. And the story continues, and the five men went on to the town of Laish, where they noticed the people living carefree lives. Like the Sidonians, they were peaceful and secure. And the people were also wealthy because their land was very fertile, so they lived a great distance from Sidon and had no allies nearby. When the men returned from Zorah and Eshtoel, their relatives asked them, what did you find? The men replied, come on, let's attack them. We've seen the land, and it's very good. What are you waiting for? Don't hesitate to go and take possession of it. When you get there, you will find the people living carefree lives. God has given us a spacious and fertile land, lacking in nothing. So the Danites assemble their war heroes. They've got 600 men. They strap on their weapons of war. They head out. They're going to go to Laish, and they're going to do battle there. But on the way, once again, they stop at the house of Micah. And these five scouts tell the rest of the army, he says, hey, there's a Levite priest living here. They've got a whole bunch of idols. What do you think we should do? And the narrator doesn't say what the rest of the tribe thinks about it, but he does record what happens. It says the five scouts entered the shrine, removed the carved image, the sacred ephod, the household idols, and the cast idol. But meanwhile, the Levite priest was standing at the gate with the 600 armed warriors. And when the priest saw the men carrying all the sacred objects out of Micah's shrine, he said, what are you doing? And they said, be quiet and come with us. Be a father and a priest to all of us, isn't it better to be a priest for an entire tribe and clan of Israel than for a household of just one man? And the text says that the young priest was quite happy to go with them. So he took along the sacred ephod, the household idols, and the carved image. And so the Levite priest, he joins the Danites with all their possessions and their children and their wives and their livestock, and they continue on. But then we've got Micah and some of his neighbors, and they run after them, and they're thinking, what's going on? You stole all these things. And they begin shouting at them, and the men of Dan turn around, and they said to Micah, what's the matter? Why have you called these men together and chased after us? And Micah says, what do you mean, what's the matter? You've taken away all the gods I have made and my priest, and now I have nothing left. The men of Dan said, watch what you say. There are some short-tempered men around here who might get angry and kill you and your family. Just theoretically, there could be some of them out here. So the men of Dan continued on their way. When Micah saw that there were too many of them for him to attack, he turned around and he went home. Then with Micah's idols and his priests, the men of Dan came to the town of Laish, whose people were peaceful and secure. They attacked with swords and burned the town to the ground. There was no one to rescue the people, for they lived a great distance from Sidon and had no allies nearby. This happened in the valley near Beth Rehob. Then the people of the tribe of Dan rebuilt the town and lived there. They renamed the town Dan after their ancestor Israel's son, but it had originally been called Laish. Then they set up the carved image, and they appointed Jonathan, son of Gershom, son of Moses, as their priest. This family continued as priests for the tribe of Dan until the exile. Then we have this concluding sentence. So Micah's carved image was worshipped by the tribe of Dan as long as the tabernacle of God remained at Shiloh. We read this text, and one of the things that we come to understand is that people are forgetful. People are forgetful. I once heard a story about two elderly women who were driving together across the country. Their names were Edith and Phyllis. And the two women were driving along in their vehicle, and they were kind of out in the countryside, and there wasn't a whole lot of vehicles around. But they were driving. Phyllis was driving, and Edith was the passenger. And they come up to a traffic light, and they can see in quite some distance away that it's red. And so they're coming up to it, and Edith is thinking to herself, wow, Phyllis is driving pretty fast for a red light coming up. They go right up to the intersection, and zoom, she goes right through. She runs the red light. And Edith thinks, oh my, Phyllis just ran that red light. Isn't that dangerous? But she thinks to herself, well, my friend's sensible enough. She must have just had the sun in her eyes or didn't see that it was a stop light, so she doesn't say anything about it. Well, another mile down the road, there's another red light approaching, and Edith is thinking, I hope Phyllis sees this one. I wonder what's going to happen. Well, the same thing happens. Phyllis just flies right on through the intersection without even looking either way and goes right through another red light. And she thinks, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to say something the next time a red light approaches. Well, shortly there is another red light, and she thinks, if she runs this thing, I don't know what's going to happen. And sure enough, Phyllis runs right through this red light. And Edith says, Phyllis, that's the third red light you've run through in the last 3 miles. And she looks at her and says, oh, am I driving? A lot of times, we can be forgetful. No matter what our age is or what we're involved with, it's just human nature to be forgetful. And in this story about the Danites and this Levite priest and Micah, we see that these people are extremely forgetful. They forget the law of the Lord. They forget their most sacred teachings. They forget how to worship, where to live, how to treat one another. And they don't just forget God. They develop this habit where they're substituting their own will and what they want to do in place of what the Lord has commanded for them. The MO of the day was doing what was right in your own eyes. And when we look at this text and compare it to other stories in Judges, we see that there's no authority figure to provide them with any direction or conviction. Everyone did as they pleased. There's no accountability, there's no conviction, there's no direction, no repentance, no correction. And we see through the course of this story and throughout the remaining chapter of Judges that when accountability ceases, sin abounds. When there is no accountability, sin increases all the more. And this is exactly what this story illustrates. In just a few generations, Moses is even mentioned in this story, just a few generations since they've taken the land, the people of God have completely forgotten their Lord. And so chaos is the result. I want us to go through a bit of an exercise. Brad introduced this last week as we looked at the story of Jephthah. And we're going to look in our Bibles, and I'd encourage you to ask yourself a couple of questions of this text. We have three kind of major character groups. We have the Levite priest, we have Micah, and we have this whole tribe of Dan. And I want us to look at the text, and I want us to ask, what are they involved in? Like, where have they gone wrong? And how do we know that they have, in fact, sinned in their lives? When I first read this story, I kind of read this story, and I was like, okay, like, what's the point? There doesn't really seem to be a whole bunch of trouble going on. They're just kind of going through their way. People are doing what they want to do, and all of a sudden, all these terrible things happen. But when we look specifically at the text, we see that all these small little decisions that they make are actually pretty blatant sin in their lives, and they had instruction that they had just forgotten to follow through. So let's begin by looking at the character of Micah. And if you have an observation, I encourage you just to shout it out, and we can all learn from your observation, and we can figure out, okay, was this in fact a sinful act, or was just this something that didn't make that much of a big deal? So when we look at Micah, what are some of the things that Micah did wrong in this story? He's a thief. Yeah, we see that he stole from his mother, and in a way, he kind of stole the priest as well, right? The priest is for Yahweh, and he takes his own personal priest. There's another comment over here. Idolatry, for sure. Sets up a shrine. He makes carved images. Yeah. Anything else out there? Yeah, for sure. Those are kind of the big major ones that we see right in the beginning of the story. We see right away in those first five verses that he and his mother actually break at least half of the Ten Commandments. Like, just boom, 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 boom. It's all there. There's a commentator by the name of J. Clinton McCann, who I was reading earlier this week. He says, given that Micah and his mother have broken at least half the Ten Commandments in only five verses, the narrator's observation that everyone did what was right in their own eyes is actually a bit of an understatement. They have created another god besides God. They've made an idol. They've used God's name wrongly. Micah has stolen, thereby failing to honor his mother, and he probably coveted along the way. All that in just that very beginning. We see that Micah is quite wayward with his actions. And another thing that was alluded to as well with the idolatry is that we see that Micah is motivated by mysticism. He's kind of got this in his mind. He's kind of developed some of the pagan traditions that are around him. He decides to return the stolen silver after he hears his mother's curse. We see that in those opening verses. His mom is looking for silver, and so she just blurts out, "Oh, curse be the man or the woman who stole my silver." And it's sort of after that that Micah's like, "Whoa, she's throwing out curses, and I'm the one that stole it." And it seems like that's what prompts him to own up to it. And he actually displays more reverence for this superstitious curse than he does for the Lord's promised curse for those who make an idol. In the law, in Deuteronomy chapter 27, the Lord says, any people who make a carved image and who worship an idol other than me will be cursed. And so we see from this story that Micah actually puts more relevance in these false gods and these superstitions than he does in the very promises of his God. We also see that he is either completely ignorant or just indifferent with regard to the law. He installs his own son as priest, which the law strictly forbade. And he demonstrates this high level of confidence with his newly hired priest, who is a Levite. So it's kind of like he knows a little bit about the law. And that scene is just so comical to me. When he sees this wandering guy, he finds out who he is, and then it's sort of like, what? You're a Levite? Oh, you're someone who should be one of Yahweh's priests, so hey, why don't you just come, and I've got my illegitimate little worship place over here, but since you're a Levite, I know that the Lord will bless me. That's what he says. It's sort of like this magic formula. And so he kind of concocts this interesting little situation that he has there. The last thing that I found in this text that's a bit interesting is that his name Micah is actually short for his full name, which is Micah Yahweh, which means who is like Yahweh. So his very name is supposed to remind people about the incredible authority and respect that you have for Yahweh, the God of Israel. And instead, he's living his life in a way that is completely opposite to his own name. He's made himself up to be his own God. He's made his own gods that he can sort of worship and do what he pleases. And in fact, he's basically saying, who cares who is like Yahweh? Because I can basically make myself Yahweh and do whatever I want to do. Micah had forgotten who the Lord was, and he put himself in his place. Because when accountability ceases, sin abounds all the more. The next character is the young Levite. Now, the young Levite's an interesting character for sure. Any comments out there for some of the things that he did wrong, some of the sins that he participated in? He was very greedy. Yeah, he was sort of like I don't know if I want to compare it given my situation. He's the pastor who's looking for the most money he can get, right? He will compromise anything and everything to get the next paycheck. Yeah, he's certainly greedy. And again, that's one of the main things that we see in this text. He doesn't really have much conviction to follow God. He's a wandering priest that we see right from the beginning of the story. And this is a bit interesting because it kind of shows us one of two scenarios. One, it could be that Israel has just been so disobedient of God that all the Levite priests are out of work because no one cares. They're all serving their own gods and doing whatever they want to do. So maybe he really is wandering around looking for a job. But the other side, and this is kind of what we see more from his character in this story, is that he was really just kind of looking for something else to do. He didn't have work, and he should have actually been living and working in Shiloh, which the text says was where the temple of the Lord, the tabernacle, God's dwelling place was. But instead, he goes very close by Shiloh to the hill country of Ephraim. In proximity, they're super, super close. We have this irony where he's wandering around looking around where he should be, and he kind of stumbles upon Ephraim when Shiloh is just right around the corner. So we see right away that he's this wandering priest with no sense of direction in his life. And as Ralph mentioned, he's motivated by riches. He uses his Levite lineage to negotiate a respectable raise from Micah. And then he exchanges his loyalty to Yahweh and his important role as a spiritual leader for all the people. And he preys upon the spiritually vulnerable. And so he offers his services to Micah, and he sets up an illegitimate practice. In the prophetic book of Hosea, the prophet describes this kind of sad behavior. He says, "The more the priests increased, the more they sinned against me. They exchanged my glory for something disgraceful. They feed on the sins of my people, and they relish their wickedness." This is very much what this Levite priest was doing. And then we see later on in the story, when he has a chance to stand up and defend his employer, as illegitimate as it may be, the Danites come and he kind of asks, "Hey, what are you doing?" And they make him a better offer. "Hey, what's one person versus a whole clan of people? That sounds better. Come be a priest for all of us." And the text says that he gladly went with them, that he was happy. And we kind of see that set up at the beginning of the story when those five scouts go and they stumble across his spot and they ask him to inquire of the Lord. And you have to think, did this priest really go inquire of the Lord? Because I think if he had, he could have said, "Actually, according to the Lord, you shouldn't be off here. You should be living over here and you should be defeating the Philistines as it was commanded for you to do." But instead, he just gives them lip service and says, "Hey, the Lord's blessed your trip." And then later on, he happens to be on their payroll. Kind of reminds me, bit of a side note, but kind of reminds me of Barry Bonds. And the fact that when he was going through all his perjury cases, that all of his friends, his so-called friends, were all on his payroll. All of them. So none of them would speak, and all the people that wanted to hang out with him were all being paid by him. And it seems to be the same sort of thing that this priest does. It's sort of like, if you'll pay me, I'll give you lip service. I'll do whatever you want to do. Sure, you're blessed. Sure, you can do this, you can do that. As long as you're paying me, that's fine. He's motivated by riches. And the last thing that we see about Micah, or excuse me, about the young Levite that's pretty interesting, is we see his lineage. He has this tarnished legacy. He isn't even given the honor of having his name mentioned early on in the story. And the narrator kind of paints this picture. We're kind of figuring out, who is this random young Levite? And then at the end of the story, when everything goes absolutely terrible, we find out that his name is Jonathan, and he's a direct relative of Moses. And so we see in just a few short generations that the Israelites have blatantly defied the Lord. And we see that when accountability ceases, sin abounds all the more. And the final group that we have, perhaps the most sinful, the most dangerous, the most catastrophic group of the whole story, are the Danites. And anyone else want to wager a few guesses as far as what did the Danites do wrong in this story? They're lazy? Yeah, for sure. They ignored where they're supposed to go? Yeah. They're murderers, for sure. Yeah. It's a sad, sad story. They unjustly conquer Laish. We've got this peaceful and unassuming people, and they're like predators. They're like, hey, these Philistines in our land, they're big and strong, and I don't really feel too motivated to do that. Certainly not call upon the Lord for help to defeat these people as we should. Let's look for some easier prey. And so they take possession of this land that's not allotted to them. And they do this without any instruction from the Lord. The only sort of instruction that they have to do this is from this illegitimate priest who they decide to pay later on. He's the only one that says, oh yeah, your journey's blessed. Go ahead and do it. But they did not take the time to consider what they were doing to the people. And so they have an unjust conquest that they have now encountered. And then subsequently they become thieves and murderers. They steal these people's lands. They kill all of them off. They take Micah's hired priest and all of his idols. And when the first, kind of the only person in the whole story that sort of has any sort of accountability is Micah, because his possessions are gone. And when he is questioned, they just threaten him with more violence. And they say, hey, if you're going to question us, you know, there's a few angry people around and we'll just kill you. So they're thieves and murderers. Our characters here sound sort of similar to the band of worthless rebels in last week's story, with wigs and all, too. Just this band of people who are violent, and they're not really sure what they're supposed to do, and they just act without any sort of conviction. Well, this story that we see in chapters 17 and 18, it reveals the problem. It reveals the problem of sin. And this desire to worship ourselves and to be idolaters. But we see that this story is not just isolated to a mother and her son. Or even to this wandering priest who gets caught up in sin. Or even of this entire tribe of Dan that goes wayward. We see later on in the story of Judges that we'll look at in two more weeks from now, we see that it actually infects every single tribe and every single person in all of Israel. The problem is the fact that this cycle of self-serving, idolatrous behavior, it infects every single person in their story and also in our story. And even for those people who try their very hardest to find a cure, they discover that they simply cannot reach it. The cure is not found in a monarchy, as the author kind of says. They didn't have a king, but we find out later on the kings really did know better themselves. In many ways, their stories were quite similar to some of the judges and some of the other people that we see in this book. So we see that the cure is not in this monarchy, and the cure is really not on depending on any single person to fix this problem. The only solution is found in doing the exact opposite of what these characters do. It's confession, it's contrition, it's declaring that Yahweh will be revered above every other thing, and then living in a way that makes it true. It's developing a heart that is actually satisfied with worshiping God and with honoring Him above everyone else. And I don't think that we can do it alone. I think that we need each other to spur each other on towards living our lives for the Lord. Because when accountability ceases, we see that sin abounds all the more. In the New Testament, in the book of Romans, we see that each person is accountable to God. The Apostle Paul writes in chapter 14 that at the end of our lives, when judgment comes about, that each one of us will be called upon to give an account of our lives to God. And so there's an accountability that is there that we need to be mindful of, that we need to remember and not to forget. And I think that our accountability to God necessitates an accountability with each other, to stay the course, to fight the fight, to keep the faith, to remember that the commitment we made to revere God is one that we need to hold fast to. And admittedly, there's been times in my life when I've had no personal accountability. Those days were self-serving and idolatrous. It was easy to live like all the characters in these stories, doing whatever seemed right in my own eyes, and not keeping people close to me who would challenge what I was doing or what I was thinking. People who would walk beside me and encourage me to live a way that would honor the Lord. And friends, my message to you this morning is, if you're in this place right now where you feel that you really are doing whatever seems right in your own eyes, where you feel like there's a disconnect between your inner life and your outward life, as if people really don't know who you are deep down, I ask that you would put yourself in an environment where trusted men and women can keep you accountable for your thoughts, for your actions. A place where you can be honest with them, where you can be prayed for, where you can be loved and supported. That is what accountability is about. It's not about people judging you and thinking terrible thoughts about you. It's about people who come with you and say, I'm just as sinful as you are. And it's just as tempting for me to do whatever seems right in my own eyes and to do this by myself. But God calls us to love one another, to be a community of believers who support each other and who walk with each other so that we may finish the race together. In just a few moments, we're going to sing a song of response. Mike and the team are going to come up and they're going to lead us through a song. And I encourage you that while we sing that song and as you meditate on those words, that you would search your heart, that you would listen to God, and that you would consider becoming involved in an accountability group of some form. There's several ways to do this. We have a number of different venues at Jericho, whether it be through a life group or whether it is through a self-called accountability group that meets together. But there's many other ways to do it. And to be honest, I don't really care how you do it. I don't really care what form that looks like. It could be with your spouse on a weekly basis. Better yet, probably with someone that is of the same gender of you. It could be with two or three women at a coffee shop. It can be over the phone. But I encourage you to really consider your heart and think, are the things inside my heart, are these things that are pure and noble things? And that you would take the time to seek out some other people that you trust and say, you know what, maybe this is something we need to have a consistent dialogue about, to really be accountable for our actions, to pray and support one another. There is a sign-up sheet over at the Welcome Center, and if you're feeling like this is a step that you'd like to take, that you would like to get into some sort of relationship where you can be accountable with each other, I encourage you to jot your name down and I'll follow up with you and make sure that we can put you in that sort of group to spur you on towards worshiping the Lord. So we're going to sing a song now called Create in Me a Clean Heart. And as I said, I encourage you just to meditate on these words and to pray out to God and listen to Him and find out where He's leading you.